some work I've done with this crowd of people. This is more co-authors than I've ever had before, so I sort of feel like an Atlas experimenter. And I don't know why the slideshow keeps... Now let's try it. Okay. Good. Okay. So it's said that there's a string landscape with roughly 10 to the 500 vacua. And you notice I've put both of those in quotes. I mean, the 10 to the 500 you should think of as a really big number. And maybe it's that, but maybe it's 10 to the 1,000 or 10 to the 510 or whatever. And vacua I'll get to in a minute, okay? Well, this might be a bad thing because it means that you can't get a unique prediction out of string theory. It might be a good thing because it might give you an explanation for the cosmological constant in the following sense. First, suppose you have some anthropic argument for why we need a small cosmological constant, okay? And Steve Weinberg gave such an argument some time ago that if the cosmological constant was much bigger than it is, and he didn't know how big it was then, galaxies wouldn't form, and if galaxies didn't form, then perimeter wouldn't form, and we wouldn't be here. That's not sufficient. What you need for that argument to work is that there also be some large distribution of theories of vacua, and enough of them that it's likely to get lambda. Some of them have lambda of the order of 10 to the minus 120. Okay. Well, 10 to the minus 120 is a lot less than 10 to the 500, so it looks good. But now you need to be a little bit careful about those. First of all, the vacua have to really be vacua. They need to be classically metastable. They have to be local minima, not just stationary points. Okay. And various groups of people have, over the past year or so, pointed out that most of the 10 to the so-called 10 to the 500 really aren't local vacua, local minima. Okay. But what we also need is that they be metastable quantum mechanically. In other words, that they not decay by tunneling so rapidly that they essentially are unstable. So what we want to look at is what's the effect of having many dimensions, many degrees of freedom on tunneling. Okay. So you can sort of look at sort of the textbook tunneling problem you do when you teach quantum mechanics. You've got 1 degree of freedom, and you have to tunnel through that barrier. If I have 2 degrees of freedom, well, now, say, if I wanted to tunnel, say, from that minimum up there, I could maybe tunnel across this way, across that way. I have many more choices. If I have 500 degrees of freedom, I have even more. And so it may be that tunneling can proceed much more rapidly. Okay, so what I'm going to describe is a study we did, which for the moment doesn't use string theory. It just is a model with many scalar fields, okay? And we'll see how tunneling proceeds with that. Okay, so rough outline. First, I'll describe the model and our strategy for looking at it. Then I'll review some facts about quantum mechanical tunneling. Then I'll show you some data and talk about its implications. Okay, so let's suppose I have a Lagrangian with some potential, which is supposed to mimic string landscape. Let me pick out one local minimum and choose my field so that minimum is at the origin and also choose them so that the quadratic term in the potential is diagonal. Okay. And since this is supposed to be a minimum at the origin, all of the coefficients there have to be positive. And then I just Taylor expand about that. I've dropped the fifth order terms, first because they won't fit there, and secondly, we're going to ignore them, but I'll justify ignoring them. Okay. And okay. And you notice I'm not assuming any particular behavior of all of those coefficients. Okay, so now what we do is choose some value of n for the number of fields and get 10,000 potentials of this sort. We just randomly choose these coefficients. Okay. Oh, and I should mention, I've taken out an overall factor lambda, and there's a dimensional scale, v, that I've put in there. Okay, now, we're going to choose these coefficients randomly from the ranges I've given, just even with an even distribution, okay? Now, if I change my choice, say, of for the quadratic term or for the cubic term, I can absorb that in a change in lambda and v. So, choosing these ranges to be 0 to 1 and minus 1 to 1 doesn't lose me any information. I'll also choose the range of this to run from minus 1, of all of these to run from minus 1 to 1. And later I'll show you I'll show you the effect of that. Okay. Now, one thing you should worry about, those ranges ought to be consistent as they go from one value of n to the next, or else I'll putting in spurious n dependence. Okay. So to think of how to do that, let me just consider a region in field space where the sum of the phi squareds is equal to some fixed value. Okay. So the typical field then has to be of magnitude 1 over root n. If I look at the quadratic term, there are n terms here, and phi squared is 1 over root n squared. So this is of order 1. If I take a cubic term, I've got 1 over square root of n 3 times for the fields. They're roughly n cubed terms, some positive, some negative, so I should expect the square root of that. And so again, I get something of order 1. Do a similar thing for the quartic terms, I get 1. So if I don't put any n dependence in my choice of the a's, then all of these will be independent of n. And if, for example, I were to restrict myself instead of the n-dimensional problem to the n minus 1 dimensional problem, the result would be consistent. Okay. So the choice is choosing these ranges to be 0 to 1 and minus 1 to 1 will be consistent. Okay. Yeah. At any order of, I can't hear you. Speak louder. Yeah, that it gives me a contribution that's independent of n. Okay, so I haven't snuck any independence in there. No, because as n increases, the typical value of the field within some fixed ball will get smaller.
So I guess it depends on the ball or a cube. Right. But if I take a ball, but now if I just take a slice through that ball, I get the same behavior. I don't get any independence by reducing number. Yeah. Okay. So tunneling with 1 degree of freedom, we know from elementary quantum mechanics, the rate is proportional to an exponential, a negative exponential, where the exponent is given by an integral through the barrier running between the two classical turning points. Okay. Now, if you have many degrees of freedom, the way to do WKB is to consider all possible paths. For each path, calculate a one-dimensional tunneling exponent in the same way. Okay. And then find the path for which the tunneling exponent is smallest. So that will be the path that will dominate. Now, if you remember from classical mechanics with signs changed, the solutions of minimizing this, which is Jacobi's principle, are the same as the solutions of minimizing the action, which is Hamilton's principle. Do the same thing now with the signs changed here, and you find that finding a stationary point of this is the same as finding a stationary point of the Euclidean action, and that's the same as solving the Euclidean equations of motion. Okay. With boundary conditions, okay, so to get Euclidean equations, I'm going to put in a Euclidean time, which basically parameterizes motion along the path through configuration space. With the boundary conditions that the initial and final time correspond to the two turning points, when you enter and when you leave the barrier, at those points, the time derivative, the Euclidean time derivative, has to vanish at both of those endpoints. And then, since it vanishes there, everything is invariant under Euclidean time reversal. It's convenient to take the tau reversed solution and put it on there, which gives you the factor of 2 that you need for the rate. Okay, and that's why these are called bouncers. Okay. In applying it to field theory, I've got, say, in a theory such as we have here, the Euclidean action, where the potential barrier is not just the barrier in V, in the field potential, but in the field potential plus the gradient terms integrated over space. Okay. So I've got to solve, here's the Euclidean equation to solve. The boundary conditions are the initial time, which turns out to be minus infinity. I'm in my initial state, my initial vacuum, the pure false vacuum over all of space. At the final time, which is here, I want to be the field, a static field, but at some configuration which has a bubble of the true vacuum surrounded by the false vacuum. And that will be the point that's on the other side of the barrier. Okay. For all values of the Euclidean time, the field at spatial infinity has to be false vacuum, or else I would get infinite energy. Okay. And then I just give you the other half to give you the bounce. Okay. Okay. Now, so far I haven't mentioned the prefactor. If you do a path integral argument, you can find an expression for the prefactor in terms of functional determinants. And on dimensional grounds, if you write this as a bubble nucleation rate per unit volume, this prefactor is going to be some characteristic mass scale of the theory to the fourth power. Okay. Now, what I need for B, if the tunneling exponent is too small, certainly if it's of order unity, then immediately you tunnel through. That's hardly a metastable state. That's not. Also, if B is small enough that when you nucleate bubbles, they're all on top of one another immediately, then the dilute gas approximation, tunneling approximation breaks down. And if you say the size of a bubble is typically one order, the order inverse of that mass, that tells you you really need B to be a good deal bigger than one. How much is a good deal? 20, 100? You can see. Okay, so finding a solution, the boundary conditions are effective, introduce an effective O4 symmetry. So it's convenient to look for O4 symmetric solutions. Okay. So if I reduce things, have my solution depend only on a radial variable, the Euclidean equation looks something like this, with the boundary conditions being that at zero, you're at rest someplace here near the true vacuum. And at infinity, you come to rest exactly at the false vacuum. Okay. Now, this is almost like the equation of motion for a particle moving with the friction. So this is a friction term, but the sign of the potential is wrong. So to get some intuition, you turn the potential upside down. And now you can think of the problem as being starting, have something start on the, at rest someplace on this slope. It will come down, it will lose energy because of friction, and maybe you'll get there. If you start too low, you'll never get it back to the top of the hill. If you start too high, even with loss of energy from friction, you'll still fly past there. There's going to be some point in the middle which will give you a solution behaving exactly as you want. And it's fairly easy to do that numerically. Now, if I have many fields, it's a whole different story. Because now, well, even just all I can visualize is one more dimension up there. This is a ridge. So if you start here, you're quite likely to fall forward from the screen down to here and never get in the neighborhood of that. So as a numerical problem, finding a solution like that is much harder. Okay. Doing it 10,000 times in a finite time is even harder than that. So we need to figure out some approximations to use. Okay. So to get some guidance, let's recall the thin wall approximation. If the two minima that I'm going between are very close in energy, then an good approximation to the solution is to have some large region of true vacuum surrounded by a thin wall and outside the false vacuum. Okay. And so for that, I can define a surface tension, which works out to this expression. And here's the energy difference. And the action has a surface area, I mean, four dimensions, which is why it's r cubed, times the surface tension, and a negative term of the volume times the energy gain by being in the false vacuum rather than the true. Okay. So now you find a stationary point of that action, you can find the radius, and you go, and there's the expression for the action, for the tunneling exponent, which usually is written this way, but I want to look at it in this form. Because in general, if the two vacua are not close to one another, this expression is clearly irrelevant. If the two vacua are not close to one another, if you look at the bounce solution, it never reaches the true vacuum. It's not sensitive to the difference between the two minima. Okay. On the other hand, you still might expect some expression like this. A surface tension term proportional to the area plus a compensating piece of roughly the same order of magnitude. So you might guess that the tension will, well, be roughly the surface area times the surface tension. Surface tension you can estimate by a similar approximation. And roughly, if you ask what's the radius of the bounce going to be, well, it's roughly going to be given by 1 over the mass scale in the problem, but it's a few times that. Okay, so let me call that number k. Okay, and use this as my estimate for the tension. So it's a factor of k cubed. There's a 1 over lambda that comes from scaling. Pi squared comes from geometry. And this is going to be, this will be essentially the surface tension with dimensional factors scaled out. So I need to know what k is going to be. So one way to do that is to just look at a family of potentials. So this is these are arbitrary potentials with cubic and quartic terms. So here's the potential, the various potentials going down. Here are the bounce solutions. So you see the first one where the minima are close together. The bounce solution really is in the true vacuum, then there's the thin wall, then the false vacuum. As you get down to here, to these lower ones, the solution starts at 0, is never near the true vacuum. And if you look at those, plug into the formula I was assuming, you find, in fact, k is fairly constant, something in the order of 5 or 6. So plugging back, that tells you that the tunneling exponent is going to be between k cubed and pi squared. It's roughly a factor of 1,000. Times the surface dimensionless surface tension, which we'll calculate, which will divided by this overall constant lambda. Okay, so how do we estimate this surface tension? Okay, so they do the following. We pick our initial vacuum, the one that's at the origin. Find all the stationary points nearby, but stationary points that have only one negative eigenvalue. Okay, so the saddle points of the barriers around it. For each one of those, we take a straight line path from the vacuum, from the origin to the saddle point, and do the line integral along that path, which would give you a surface tension. So this is certainly an overestimate, because some curved path might be better. There might be some slightly better place to go down, but this will gives you an upper bound on what? On the tunneling action. Okay. So we do this for each one of the stationary points. Find the stationary point that gives us the lowest value for the surface tension. Okay. And we'll call that S. Okay. And then we'll say that the tunneling exponent for that potential is S. Yeah. But okay, with one field doing a one-dimensional path. And I'm doing, essentially doing one-dimensional paths here. So I'm saying what could happen? Okay, so if I do follow this algorithm, the bounce I get in that one-dimensional slice should be similar to the one-dimensional problem. Now, it could be that if I take into account that I might twist around, that will give me a better factor. But I wouldn't expect it to be much better. I mean, it certainly. Yes. No, but I think it's similar, because this is a one-dimensional, doing it this way is a one-dimensional problem. Okay. I mean, the fact that it should be some constant times the radius, so some constant times 1 over the mass scale. And dimensionally, you wouldn't expect that to be very big. It's only very big when you get to the thin wall approximation, because then you've put in another small number. Okay. So now we do this 10,000 times. Okay. So here, what I've plotted, for each value of n, the median value of s, so in other words, the median value of the optimal surface tension is given by, shown by that dot, the 25th and 75th percentiles are marked at by the end of those bars. Okay. And you see on a log-log plot that fits a straight line fairly well. Okay. If you extract numbers from it, it's saying s is going like n to the minus 2.66. Okay. So in other words, as we get more degrees of freedom, the optimal s, the optimal surface tension, and therefore the optimal action, is falling fairly rapidly. Okay. You see the same thing if you look at the barrier height at the top of the optimal path is also falling like a power of n. Okay. And those points, the distance of those points to the origin is also getting smaller like a power. Okay. And of course, the closer they get to the origin, the less important the fifth and sixth order terms are. Okay. The number of stationary points grows exponentially. Okay. So, to justify dropping the quintic terms, let me see what happens if I drop the quartic terms. Okay. And you see, so this just comes from keeping the quadratic and cubic terms. And you see there's a slight change in the exponents and in the prefactors. But it's not very big. And so I think it's safe to say that if we'd put in the quintic terms, that the change would have been very small, except we might not have had the data by now. Okay. Okay. Varying the range of the scale for the quartic coefficients. Well, we chose it to be run from minus 1 to 1. If we'd chosen that to be 0, well, then we get the cubic, purely cubic term, which didn't vary very much. If we make it larger, that just gives us a smaller value for s, but not tremendously small. I mean, increasing it up to 20 cuts down s by about a factor of 4, maybe. One thing you might worry about is if I'm thinking of the string landscape with maybe 500 moduli, coefficients, if I do a Taylor expansion about some minimum, you know, the coefficients are related. They're not really 500 cubed independent cubic terms, for example. So you might ask, what happens if you put in relations between the coefficients? So one way to do that is to just take a supersymmetric potential, expand the superpotential that way, the way we have, but then put it together when you go from the superpotential to the real field potential, there'll be all sorts of correlations between terms. If you do that, though, you still end up getting very similar results. It's just the exponent gets slightly bigger, okay? But the results, all the graphs look exactly the same. Okay, now, what we need to know is not just how the median is varying as we go along, but the deviations from the median, okay? So this is a confusing graph for various reasons. So let me explain it. Okay, so here's n. The colors are n. Here, I've plotted for each n s over s median. And ignore the numbers on the side. The vertical axis is the log of the number of points. So we take 10,000 points, bin them according to the value, how they deviate from the median, and then plot it on a log plot. And you see for each particular color, things fall roughly exponentially. Okay, and we've just added constants so the plots don't all fall on top of one another. So the absolute height here is irrelevant. If you fit those two exponentials, the exponents are all roughly a third. Okay. So we're saying within some ensemble, the number with the outliers with large exponents, with large surface tensions, which will be the long-lived vacua, fall exponentially as S over S median. Okay. So if we ask how many metastable vacua are there, well, the number with the fraction with some high value of S is given by this. Now, S is related to the tunneling exponent, B, which is what I want, by this. This is our numerical factor coming back. Okay. S median, we saw, fell like an inverse power of N. Okay. So putting those factors in, it says the fraction with B greater than some particular minimum value is going to look like this. It's going to be fall exponentially like some constant times n to the e to the minus b times n to the alpha. Okay. So for large n, the fraction with some with tunneling exponent greater than some preset value is going to fall exponentially. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, to see how this works out, let's suppose that the number of vacua goes something like this, like a power, like the nth power of some number, which, say, if you want 10 to the 500, that's assuming F is roughly of order 10, okay? So this is the number of vacua, okay? But the number that are metastable, the number for which tunneling exponent is larger than some given number, is going to be given by this, okay? Now, to solve the cosmological constant problem, what do we need? First, we need n to be big so that we can have, so that this number is bigger than 10 to the 120. Okay. But now we're going to get in trouble. If n gets too big, this factor here is going to grow and grow faster. This will get smaller faster than this gets larger. So in particular, if you want this number to be bigger than 10 to the 120, taking some logs, you get this factor. So clearly, I need n to be bigger than the right-hand side, say roughly 120. On the other hand, if n gets too big, this left-hand side will become negative. Okay. And now keep in mind that this factor b is 10 to the minus 3 times lambda times b minimum. Okay, so to see what this looks like, let me take the exponent I got from our quartic potentials. If I take F to be like this, so that's saying there are 10 to the n vacua, then the metastable vacua have to fall to the set to the left of the solid curve. If I take it to be 100, it's the left of the dash curve. So that's saying that even if you choose, well, if you choose n badly, if n is too small, you'll just, you won't get satisfactory vacua. If you get it too big, you're much more constrained. But even choosing it to be around here, this number then has to be 10 to the minus 4 or less. Okay. If I choose, if I took the supersymmetric data where the exponent just varied from 2.7 up to 3.1, you get the same sort of picture, but things are down by another order of magnitude. So you're clearly very sensitive to that exponent. Yeah, yeah, I'm saying, yeah. So, to solve this, right, so this is the line that makes it inequality, okay. And you want to be on the left, on the left side of there, okay. Okay, so even if you choose n, you know, optimally, and taking into account the factor of 1,000, lambda times B minimum has to be less than 0.01, some number between 0.01 and 0.1. Lambda is just this factor we got by expanding taking a point in the landscape and Taylor expanding about that. There's no reason that lambda should be particularly small. You know, it's not necessarily a small constant. Okay, so let's see what is B going to be. Well, if you wanted just for metastability, B has to be certainly bigger than 1 and probably bigger than 10 or more than that, maybe 100, okay, which is going to make it hard to meet that. That's fine. Yeah. If you want to have eternal inflation, well, for eternal, I've written this badly. For eternal inflation, this should be less than 1. You want to be going slowly. My sign is wrong there. Well, if M is the mass scale of your theory, say if M was a gut scale, you need 10 to the 20 times e to the minus b to be less than 1. So b had better be of the order 60, 70 or more, which will make it hard to do that. One vacua I particularly like is this one, okay? And it's lasted a long time, and I'd like it to last at least to the end of the conference. So for that to be so, I need gamma times h to the minus 4 to be less than 1, okay? So we haven't tunneled. And I don't know what mass scale to put in for the barriers around us when we put this vacuum into the landscape. But say, even if you said it was, the barriers are typically 1 GeV high, then B has to be the order of 500 or more, which will make it very hard to be there, okay? So, getting to my summary and reading Matt's time limit. Okay, so what have we done? We've extrapolated from simulations with n of 1 or 2 or 9 or 10 up to hundreds. Okay, you might say that's an outrageous extrapolation, but well, from 1 to 10, we got very nice straight lines and so on. And what we find, as you increase n, the decay rate rises fairly rapidly. You weaken metastability. So if you want to explain the cosmological constant, what you need on the one hand is a large N, so you have many potential vacua. And you want N to be not too big, because if it's too big, those vacua all decay too rapidly. So you can quite easily be at the point where you want N to be at least this high, but no higher than this, and so things won't work. Now, what we need to do, and will do, is to go to the real problem. First, you have to include gravity, which in general won't be much of an effect unless we get to Hawking-Moss transitions, okay? But we need to apply it to the string landscape, okay? And see what happens there. And after all, the problem is it's not just taking some random supergravity model and then seeing what happens. You know, things could work if you could find some corner of the landscape where things did not behave such as this. You know, for example, something which nobody complained about, but you might have, if you think about macromolecules, have a tremendous landscape, many enormous numbers of degrees of freedom. Okay, the potential landscape has as many dimensions as this, but those tend to be stable. Okay, so how can that be? Well, early on, when I wrote down this potential and Taylor expanded, you know, I assumed that that there was no correlation. So I assumed that I had a potential that's a function, arbitrary function of 500 variables, say. But if instead the potential was a sum of 25 terms, each of which was a function of 20 variables, then this analysis would have been quite different. So, for instance, if the landscape were to work like that, and I don't see any reason why it should, but if a piece of the landscape works like that, you could be okay. You could find some argument for some minimum tunneling rate, then maybe you could work. On the other hand, maybe it doesn't work. Okay. Okay, thank you.
I actually have two questions. First of all, do you know what happens for macromolecules, or is it understood at all? But let me go ahead with the second question. I mean, I think basically one thing you might imagine is that supersymmetry is what is protecting us. And so basically you have, many of the degrees, so N is 500 or something, but many of those things are stabilized supersymmetrically. And so you don't have to worry about those decays. And then just a couple of moduli are stabilized down at the GeV scale, so that the effective N that we have to worry about for decays of our vacuum would be, you know, 3 or 4.
Possibly. I mean, you're saying, yes, we start from some supersymmetric ADS vacuum, which we raise up, and you say, if you don't raise it too much,
yeah.
Okay. But it's not clear to me that all the other, you know, so when it was supersymmetric, you still had barriers around in other directions. As you raise it up, you have to ask, how, you know, not just going from between the two states, but going from the raised vacuum to the neighboring ones.
Right.
That can easily give you many more. I agree, but
that's right. And I think people made some estimates for, you know, so in the original case, then you're protected from tunneling to those neighboring ones,
right.
but now you've broken supersymmetry, so you could go there.
Right.
And people made some estimates for how slow that rate is. I think there's
right,
a lot
but you don't have to go just between those two. You can now have all sorts of other directions to worry about.
Right.
Yeah.
Other directions were protected before you broke supersymmetry.
Right.
And so you might think you still have some protection, and there are some formulas people wrote down. But yeah, I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, I think that
that's why we really have to go to the landscape and see.
So two things. One, for the record, and this may be an invitation to do a discussion offline, I'd reject that the string theory landscape is obsolete, at least as of now. The statement that there are lots of vacuum, in particular 10 to the 500th, is based on negative energy objects known as oriented folds, and we now know those are unstable, badly unstable. And the second question was, it looked like most of your analysis was essentially one-to-one vacuum tunneling, and the dependence of N came in just because you decided to have a particularly nice Taylor expansion around the, so it didn't look like we were looking at lots of tunneling, it looked like we were looking at the characteristics of a potential based on the that you wanted to have some nice properties.
No, having many degrees of freedom means you can tunnel in many more directions, right?
Yeah, but it looked like what you were doing was essentially just one-to-one, and you had barrier heights, et cetera, that were explicitly dependent on N. Did I misunderstand that?
No. I was saying, so we start from some vacuum. Now look in the n-dimensional space around you for the best place to tunnel. And the fact that, you know, for example, the number of stationary points increases like exponentially with n. So it's having many more directions to tunnel, and that's where the n-dependence comes in. That gives you the enhanced tunneling.
So I'll ask a question. So what about the prefactor? I know there was, like Alex Kusenko wrote a paper in the 90s about well, what happens if you had a continuous degenerate set of vacua? And there you see that the enhancement in the rate, even though it seems like you should have an infinite number of other places you can tunnel, really just goes like some power law.
No, it's not even that. If you just have some, say U1 symmetry in the potential, right. you just get a length measuring that.
Right.
The size of the group, yeah.
So if it isn't random, if it's, you know, if there is some reason for you to expect a certain, you know, characteristic barrier width, when you go to the real string theory landscape, et cetera, et cetera, it seems like you're really relying on it. You're really relying on the random chance being large that you have some close by vacuum when you increase n. Is that where most of this is coming from?
But the chance of having a nearby vacua, remember, is grows with n.
Right. So the random chance is increasing with the more degrees of freedom you have.
Yeah, so here, you know, the distance to the nearest minimum is falling like a power of n.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but I'm saying that if there was some underlying symmetry, if it was not completely random,
yeah,
then, you know, then it might not increase so fast. With this sort of n sphere of degenerate vacua being the example that I had in my mind.
Right, but why you should have, I mean, some smaller sphere perhaps, but certainly all the moduli are not going to be coming symmetrically at all.
Right.
Yeah.
That I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, one more question.
You made a reasonably compelling case, but it didn't completely compel me.
Okay.
In terms of what is absolutely critical for all of these random throws of the dice, which is the prior probability of the coefficients, which you said should be uniform in a expansion of V to low order. Sometimes stringy motivated things, you often see that the potentials will explicitly involve exponential terms in them, and those are not included. And
No. We're just saying do a Taylor series about some point.
Well,
take some random minimum.
It's true, except that there all of these flattenings of potentials come about by various mechanisms. And with an expansion like this, you would get a little bit of the rise, but you don't actually go very far out. And, you know, there are all sorts of flow patterns as you go towards a minimum, and then you find this little spot where you have to tunnel out of, as opposed to being able to find one of these arbitrarily many trajectories down. Anyway, I guess what I'm really asking is the level at which you've explored that. I tend not to like throwing the dice on potential coefficients when we're doing phenomenology of inflation, because you have to reject a huge amount of trajectories, for example. This is an unrelated problem, but it is a problem which does involve the issue, which is extremely important in that case, of what you choose as a prior for the kind of expansion coefficients, the mode functions you use, et cetera. And here, and in McAllister's work, et cetera, there are these fairly, in my view, relatively simple assumptions. So I've seen your justification. Yeah. So you're completely sold on that justification.
Okay, well, first of all, I'll say the fact that the coefficients are random, truly random, is not important. It's that they be well scattered, that they be well distributed. Right, because you can have, you know, the functions can put in some non-randomness, the true potential, but the coefficients, when you actually do the Taylor expansion, may make them out even, make them out looking sort of random in the colloquial sense, not the technical sense. Okay, whether the landscape, even in some, will find some particular sets of vacua where this fails, that needs to be looked at. Also, something that you might have asked is the kinetic terms. Typically, okay.
Which is actually how the sometimes you say the exponential.
Yeah. So now what you have to do is, by change of variables, you can make the non-standard kinetic energy locally look like a standard kinetic energy, and at least to the extent we've looked at it, it looks like that's not going to hurt you. In fact, it may make tunnel even more likely. But this is all of what has to be done.
And just as another minor thing, but I don't really see exactly how it's included in this, but and you had it as an expansion with various, if we expand in radius as well as angles, almost all of the variables, once throwing the dice on, are angular variables. In the sense that there's a leading, if I make a vector phi, which is r, and then a whole bunch of angles representing all of the other degrees of freedom, then we have an r squared, an r cubed, and an r to the fourth, a huge number of angular variables, which could have more protection than would be allowed by random.
Yeah, but you're assuming that there is some particular symmetry. I mean, because I could also equally well think of that as choosing Cartesian coordinates within a sphere.
And that's exactly what I'm referring to, that essentially one's going to angular coordinates and using them as the guide on how the dice should be thrown.
But there isn't really the radial direction is not really special in this.
It can be, but probably not.
Yeah.
Okay, let's thank Eric again.